I don't blame you for thinking I'm bad. I am, I know it.
I'm not bad. I'm just drawn that way.
It's movie time.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Time Podcast from your Pop Zara pals over at popzara.com. A lot of peas. I need a pee filter, Ethan. I need a pee filter. And that sounds gross. What's up, everybody? This is Nathan Evans, managing editor of that aforementioned Pop Zara website. And in the back, co-host Ethan Brehm. Ethan, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
Now, you know what's funny? Real quick. For everybody who don't know, the format is Ethan and I pick some movies. We try to keep them coordinated. We try to see if we can match them. Sometimes we're good at it. Sometimes it's a hopeless case. This time around, Ethan got to pick. No surprises if you see what's on the marquee. But Ethan, I'll tell you this. When I first started watching these films, it was really difficult for me to really see what you were trying to connect. And then afterwards, I got it.
Yeah, and you kind of need to watch one of them all the way through to see the connection, I think.
And I'll tell you one thing. I'm going to say one thing before we go off. I love the fact that I now know that Steven Spielberg and Robert Zemeckis and all these people, they watched an erotic thriller and they decided, are you killing a script over there?
Me? Oh, sorry. Oh, it's right next to the microphone.
How it is. Dial E for Ethan. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway, they watched an erotic thriller and put that character in Roger Rabbit.
Yeah.
Did you notice
that? I mean,
that?
Why not? Why not? Yeah.
Like, it's sort of like, what was that movie with Jeremy Irons where he won the Oscar? Reversal of Fortune, where mm-hmm. he played the killer, and he has that quote where he says, "You have no idea." And then Disney.
Oh, and then he uses it in Lion King?
Yeah, he uses it in Lion King.
He says the same exact line.
Same line. It's obvious what it is, and I think that's what you get when you watch Body Heat and Roger Rabbit. Like, it's obvious, because I guess Lucas helped make this movie? Helped make Body Heat? I didn't know that.
Did he really? Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
It's crazy.
That slipped my radar.
Well, if you really think about it, it makes perfect sense. Like, if you really think about it. We're spoiling all the good stuff. Ethan, you got to pick two movies this week, so chronologically, what did we pick?
So we got 1954's Dial M for Murder, an Alfred Hitchcock movie. And then we have Lawrence Kasdan's 1981 erotic thriller, Body Heat.
Erotic thriller, 1980s.
Started the trend, I think, if you look back. It's kind of the one that made the blueprint for Fatal Attractions, Basic Instincts, and 9 1/2 Weeks, all that stuff.
All that stuff. And with diminishing returns up to a point.
Some of them are really good.
Some of them are great.
And you get into the 90s and there's a lot of like the pay-per-view stuff. And then that's when you start getting
Skinamax.
The real trash. Yeah.
Skinamax.
Exactly.
Red Shoe Diaries. All that trash.
Yeah.
By the way, I think maybe the last of those films that anybody gave a damn about before they became parodies of themselves with like Striptease and... what was the one with...
Showgirls.
Showgirls. Like those, I think by that time it was done. But I think probably the last one of these anybody took seriously was Basic Instinct.
That's a good movie.
It's a great movie. Great director.
Really good movie, yeah.
Wasn't that... But Paul Verhoeven, didn't he also
make... Yeah, he also did Showgirls, yeah.
Yeah, which, by the way, is also kind of great.
I kind of love Showgirls. I like Striptease, too, which came out the year after, or the same year as Showgirls.
Is that Demi Moore?
Yeah. And Burt Reynolds, actually.
I was going to say... Thank you for telling me that, because for some reason I always segue Burt Reynolds with Striptease and Boogie Nights.
Oh yeah, totally. Like, it's kind of the same character almost.
Yeah, well, he was nominated for an Academy Award for one of them, but I was like, what smutty film was Burt Reynolds in the 90s involving strippers? Like,
no, Striptease is so good. Oh, it's definitely one that I watched as a kid, and they'd like, you know, on TV, and they'd cover up the nipples and stuff, but it was like
digital pasties.
I loved it because it was like really, it was like an entertaining like actiony thriller, like campy thing, and I just really liked it for
it's
like face value, I guess.
It's the creator of RoboCop and Starship Troopers.
Oh, it was the same director.
Yeah, is it Paul Verhoeven?
I meant Striptease.
Oh, I don't know. No. You know what? I don't really have
sorry,
a lot of...
So, they're basically the same movie.
Oh, okay. Well,
yeah.
I'll say this. There's Striptease and Showgirls.
Showgirls, yeah.
Showgirls has become like Troll 2 level adored.
Oh, yeah. Well, the dolphin sex scene is the famous one.
Oh my goodness, yes. Yeah, squeak, squeak. Thank you. What's the actor's name again? Who's in that from Dune?
Elizabeth Berkley.
No, that's Saved by the Bell. She was definitely not in Dune.
Wait, what?
The actor, main actor, remember, from Twin Peaks?
Oh, the main guy, Kyle
MacLachlan.
MacLachlan, yeah.
Yeah. By the way, he kind of looks like Mickey Rourke a little bit. Or he looked like Mickey Rourke in Body Heat.
Yeah.
No, but anyway, people listening have no idea what clue we're talking about. We're talking about sex movies here. Sex. So let's talk about a movie with no sex. Let's talk about Dial M for Murder.
Yeah, let's do it.
What has 1954 sex? Awkward kissing?
Yeah, like very much implying things. It's Hitchcock, so he's trying to eschew the Hays Code back then. But
you know what's funny? Yeah. Before we get into the film, I just want to let's get this out of the way. This was a 3D movie.
Yes. I'm not sure what the history of that was or why it was 3D, but it's still shown a lot of times in 3D when it plays in theaters, and it was released on 3D, Blu-ray 3D.
Yeah, that's where most people saw it. I know a little of the history because we repeat history. Those who forget history are going to repeat it.
Yeah.
Hollywood is like, hey, these 3D movies are making us extra money. It's cheap. Let's go ahead and post-convert it or whatever. And they said, Hitchcock, you need to do this. And I think Hitchcock had never done a 3D film, and I don't think he ever did one after. But he went through all this trouble with dual riggings, and you can kind of see it if you watch the film, like what he means by that. But no, almost nobody saw this movie in 3D because they had problems with the projector, they had problems with this. So naturally, like 99% of the people who've ever seen this movie have only seen it as God intended in 2D. So.
And I've heard people say that it's actually like the best 3D movie ever besides like Avatar, in the original, like of the old ones, like the old 50s 3D movies where the craze, like that this is the best one because it doesn't create a gimmick out of it. Yeah.
There's like two scenes that I think are gimmicky, but like they're very slight.
The main ones. Yeah. Like it but I've heard people say it just kind of brings a dimensionality. I mean, literally to the movie that is kind of makes you feel like you're in the room, and it works, I'm sure, for certain scenes when the location is important, where he's like kind of going around the apartment and stuff.
There were some quotes that he wanted it to be more like a stage production, like to have that.
And it's based on a play. It's based on a play, and even the opening shot is it's a like a freeze frame. I don't know what that's called on stage, but there's kind of like, like Jay Giles' band, yeah. But yeah, it's very almost one location. It doesn't even go to like the courthouse or the police station at all.
No,
it's like almost its entire. Even like when they show her court, it's very surreal. Yeah.
Well, you know what's funny? Who is the star of Inside the Actors Studio? What was his name?
Leach.
Was it?
No, I don't know.
James Lipton.
I was going to say Robin Leach, but I knew it was an L name.
Robin Leach is awesome, too.
Robin Leach.
That would be funny, him hosting
Inside
a film
the
show.
Studio. Yeah.
We have a quiet thing here. Like, his accent is undefinable. Like,
tell us about your motives.
So we are rich on the boat. But it's like, are you British? Are you Australian? What the hell are you?
Nobody knows what he is.
But James Lipton, though, I used to love that show. And he had my favorite episode of all time, no surprise, was when he had the cast of The Simpsons on. And he was praising them. He said, I think The Simpsons is the best written show in television history, which up to a point it kind of was. And by the way, there are connections with The Simpsons and Body Heat. Did you know that? But I'd really have to stretch to make those connections. But he used to say that The Simpsons is the type of show that you could just listen to the dialogue and get everything out of it because it was so well written.
Yeah,
and I would say you could say the same for Dial M for Murder. Like if your pitcher tube went dead and all you could do was hear it, this is something that could easily be on the radio, and you could get everything out of it. I think like it's so dialogue heavy,
especially the scene between Tony and Swan, the guy who ultimately gets murdered.
Yes.
But
so,
by the way, I think we're going to spoil a lot of stuff.
Yeah, let's just say this.
Seen these movies. I think we have to spoil in order to talk about both of these.
I would say there's two things. We're going to spoil it, but you've probably already been spoiled because you're alive and you've watched other movies.
Exactly.
Because these are the genesis of so many tropes. Which came first, Dial M for Murder or Strangers on a Train?
Strangers on a Train came first. That was 40-something. Definitely came first.
Remade as Throw Mama from the Train, by the way.
Yeah, not as good.
Which I heard they're making a sequel to.
A sequel?
Yeah. I don't understand that. Well, they said they were going to make a sequel to Twins, and that never happened.
That's true.
But, you know, the whole concept, and Hitchcock has played with this concept a billion times, of you murder for me, and I'll murder for you, or I'm gonna have you murder, I'm going to manipulate you into murder. This is the perfect murder. Back and forth. It's well-trod roads for Hitchcock.
Yeah, the perfect murder is definitely a theme. You see it in Shadow of the Doubt, which is, like, one of his earliest, I think it was right, was that his British years? It might have been like one of his last British movies, but yeah, you see it there, and you see it also, I mean, obviously here, but yeah, extensively. He even talks about it. He says the phrase perfect murder, like you can't do a perfect murder. Like it's part of the dialogue in a lot of his movies even.
Yes. Very obsessed with, I think, as a control freak, and I think no one would accuse Alfred Hitchcock of not being a control freak.
Yeah.
I think you'd be insulted if you didn't. But
yeah,
the idea that he's the engineer and his playwrights are the engineers and they're going to sort of reverse engineer how can we create the perfect murder and get away with it. Remember one of my favorite Hitchcock, you say this is one of your favorites, I don't know what your first is. Likewise.
Psycho.
Oh, of course. One of my favorites though is the movie Rope. I don't know if
Rope. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I love Rope.
Rope is fantastic.
And
yeah.
Rope is this concept taken to its logical extreme.
Yeah. It's an intellectual, it's more of like a it's the probably his most twisted movie from a like a motive perspective. Like they're literally just killing to prove that they can get away with it.
It's almost like a sexual thrill, and I think
yeah, it's so weird. Yeah,
well, it's been reinterpreted as like a gay film too because of that.
Oh really? Okay,
yeah,
that makes
sense. But that's here's a disclaimer. Most films have been re-described as gay cinema, but in fact, Body Heat, which we'll get into, actually I believe that has an element of that in too. But,
that was one of the things when I was watching it kind of drew me to it as a Hitchcockian parallel, because I started thinking about Dial M for Murder and Shadow of a Doubt and even like a little bit Notorious, but for different reasons.
Yeah.
I was going to say, just going on a little Hitchcock tangent a little bit. So
you can never have enough.
So. That's true. But like, so what I think makes Psycho so cool and so great in context of a Hitchcock movie is whereas most of the murders that happen in his movies are very meticulous, planned out. Whereas in Psycho, it's messy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like he does, it's all spontaneous. It's just more of like a knee jerk thing. He just like, I can't help myself. And then he just murders, Janet Leigh's character and then has to say, okay, how am I going to cover this thing up?
Well,
he's like wiping up the floor and he's wrapping her up and like the car doesn't even almost sink all the way and like all this stuff. And so, but then on the same line, you have this weird, Hitchcock plays with the audience and he almost makes you like nervous for the murderer, which is, he does that here, obviously. And he does it in Body Heat does that same kind of thing where you're like, why am I nervous for this villain? Like to execute this, plan.
Let's just come out and say it. The villain is the protagonist.
Like, exactly.
If you think about it, the villain is the protagonist. They outline everything. Everything is outlined meticulously. Like,
yeah.
I don't mean a little bit. Like, it's, especially in Dial M for Murder, it's the most meticulously thought out, transposed, implemented, everything. Everything is thought out. And that's the movie, is that the arrogance of the master storyteller, of the planner, goes afoul. And that's where the entertainment comes
in. He's really good at improvising too. And he successfully improvises for most of the movie. And it's just one fatal mistake, an oversight even, is what kind of ends up being his undoing.
Let's just say it's Agatha Christinian.
Christinian. It's Christinian.
Like you could say Hitchcockian, you know what I'm talking
about.
Yeah,
right? That makes sense. Yeah, or like Kafka-esque.
But we don't have her, and she's the most influential writer of all time in that
sure.
genre.
Yeah, definitely.
And Hitchcock loves her too. But yeah. It's sort of like there's even a scene in Dial M for Murder where you get like the Hercule Poirot where he's like, oh, mm-hmm. one more thing. You know, and that becomes Columbo. He's like, oh, and one more thing. Yeah. One more thing. And I'm going to deduce everything. And the fun part is watching it happen. You know, I mean, yeah. I don't want to compare this unfavorably, but if you've ever watched Columbo, if you've ever watched any of those damn shows, they're all formulaic, but that's kind mm-hmm. of the fun of it. And that's what Dial M for Murder is. You see the murder, you're seeing it happening. You see, not the murder, but you know what I mean? You're seeing the plot unfoil, and then the detective comes in. You know what happened. And when the detective comes to the realization, it's usually based on one thing that they didn't think about. And I think, spoiler, in Dial M for Murder, it's the key.
Yeah.
Literally, the key is the key. But,
yeah.
And in Body Heat, which we'll get into, it's something else. But,
yeah. And you even see this in Knives Out, right? Like, for anyone, mm-hmm. you've seen Knives Out, right?
That's the first one or the second one?
The first one. Where the thing that kind of tips you off has been there since the beginning. Like, you could realistically solve, you could solve the case yourself if you really paid enough attention, I guess. And that's what kind of makes these fun.
Well, that's, you know, you remember the movie Misery with Kathy Bates, right?
Yeah.
And James Caan. The most iconic scene in that movie is where she's describing what makes certain movies fun and what they don't make them fun. Where mm-hmm. she talks about going to the serials and how the character, the good guy will jump out and save. She's like, oh, they're cheating. They cheated the audience, right?
Yeah.
And it's one thing to cheat the audience and Deus Ex Machina and say, well, you didn't see this. It's another thing to do Hitchcockian, like you're talking about, or even Knives Out, or the good films, where they don't cheat you. It's right there. You just didn't see it
mm-hmm.
until you watch it again, or maybe three times,
yeah.
maybe four. Like, but when they cheat, it's not fun. It takes you out of it.
Yeah, and whereas so yeah, like a lot of giallo stuff does that, where it's like, wait, what? That person was the murderer? That doesn't even make
okay,
sense.
Okay, first of all, giallo stuff, yeah, reality doesn't apply. So
yeah, exactly. But what Hitchcock is so good at too is he shows you the secrets right or like early on. Like he does this all the time. Like you see who the killers are, you see the secret of the villain and all this stuff. And here you see it too. Like you see. The husband has his own secrets, and then the wife has her own secrets, and they don't necessarily know each other's secrets, although he does. But like, as an audience, you see everything on the table. The only thing we don't know is what the inspector is thinking about, right? And that's kind of used as a tool. But we see everything, and what Hitchcock always says is, what's more suspenseful? A family sitting at a table and all of a sudden a bomb goes off, or you knowing that there's a bomb exactly. under the table and the family doesn't, and the whole time you're just on the edge of your seat waiting for the bomb to go off.
In this movie, like, the basic plot, the threadbare plot, is you have a sort of a has-been tennis pro who marries a very rich woman in Britain,
mm-hmm.
right? Look, with all due respect, with transatlantic accents, but any movie... Yeah. made before like 1995, like they get away with this crap where they would put Americans.
Oh, you can't. Yeah.
Yeah. Or they.
There's no line.
Yeah. They Dick Van Dyke it where they just say, "Oh, jolly good, Governor. I'm a British man now. I is." You know, it's just like Cockney. But you know what I mean? It's like we don't know who's really British here. The accents there all over the place. And so, and by the way, the marketing for that, this being a British film, was part of the marketing. Like, oh, it took over two continents.
Yeah, because he was originally a British director, and then mm-hmm. now he's been doing a lot of American stuff. This is actually the first film in his what people consider his golden age, by the way, of Hitchcock. Yeah. His first, and then it goes from here all the way to Marnie, I think in 1965. It was like 11-12 movie run. Before this, it was called Early Hollywood, from Rebecca, I think, all the way to whatever was that before this one.
And there is something, I mean, we can talk for hours about how there was something unique about the British mystique that I think added class to a bunch of things, which it's a prejudice that exists to this day, like with fantasy films and prestige things. Like if you want that British accent.
Exactly, and that's a good point, actually, because if you're watching this and you're like, oh, this is a very American movie, it kind of takes this, like, he kind of uses this romanticism against you, right? Whereas, mm-hmm. like, this is a sick and twisted story. Like, this is about, like, three really not great people, right? And actually, mm-hmm. the more understandable of the three sinners is the most egregious in what he's trying to do, right? He's trying to like murder his wife. but he has the most understandable motive if you really think about it, whereas everyone else is just kind of like acting on like hedonism, I guess, for lack of a better term. But I think if you have, and even the music plays at the beginning of the movie, you have the music and it's kind of like sweeping and you're like, oh wow, this is like a very like romanticized 50s film, and then it keeps going and you're like, this is actually very, very dark.
Well, was this movie made after the Hays Code?
No, this is during the Hays Code. Hays Code was about 1934 through, and it kind of fizzled out. It didn't really have like a distinct ending, but the MPAA didn't start until 68.
Okay. Because there's elements of every Hitchcock film I've ever seen up to a point where it seems like he was able to traipse over it and sort of play around certain elements of it.
Oh, even in, like, oh my gosh, Psycho's even like the biggest example,
I wonder if Psycho may have helped end part of it. Like, there's, like, I know it ended. I know it ended in the 60s, but there was no, like, absolute, like, okay, it's over, you can make smutty movies.
They couldn't even show the toilet flushing in Psycho. Yeah. I mean, that was, like, a big, big deal of contention was, they're like, you can't show a toilet flushing, and he was like, why can't I show a toilet flushing? Like,
there's all these things. Stabbed, but no flushing.
I mean, Psycho is probably one of the most graphic American movies in that era.
I can see why people are flocking to French cinema, to be honest.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, the thorough put is that you get this failed tennis star who's married a rich lady, and she's of course having an affair with an American mystery writer, and they get the fun part comes for me. You mentioned something. I want to bring that up because it happens in both films. Is that we learn that he's going to double cross and he's going to manipulate someone he used to go to school with because he's been following him and he realizes he's kind of a bad dude, and he's able to, and he's been stalking him for a long time. And there's the quote, and I didn't clip it, but you know the line where he says, oh, I followed you so much I felt like I was sort of a god, like I had power over you.
Yeah.
Like, because, you know, you get that, because he's describing voyeurism, which is which is kind of what he would do with, was it Jimmy Stewart in Rear Window? Where you have someone who has the advantage of being able to see and spot you and monitor you, and maybe even influence you if he wanted to, because that's what he's doing, he's influencing. And he proceeds to lay out his plan. And to me, that's my favorite part of the movie, where he's saying, this is what's happening, this is what's happening. And if you watch the film, I said you could listen to it, but I guess I was wrong. But if you watch his actions while he's explaining this to, what was his name again? It's
Swan.
Swan. When he's explaining what's going to happen, he's so meticulous. He lays the gloves out. He hands them. Everything he does is intentional. He drops the letter so he can get the fingerprint. He gets the fingerprints on here. He does everything meticulous. He's planned everything out. Everything. Every detail. And that's when you know something bad's going to happen.
Yeah. And when I first watched this movie, I remember thinking when he drops the envelope or the letter and then he picks it up, I remember thinking, oh, that's going to come into play later. But
of course
no,
it does.
But what I thought was funny is that it kind of comes into play right away. So you think you have an edge on the story here, but really it's like, okay, no, this is going to pay off in like a minute.
Yeah.
And it does, you know, but it's like, it just goes to show that as much as you think about what's going on, as much as you're up on what's happening in the plot, like, you still don't see the final.
Well, exactly.
I don't think you can see the final twist coming, and it's right there in front of you too, which is so funny.
Well, the best part is he's not making him an offer he can't refuse. He's making him an offer he needs to comply. Like, I've got you by the balls. I've got everything I've done has trapped you. You cannot escape. You must take this offer. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And like I said, and there, I have some issues with the denouement, like the resolution at the end. But of course, same for Body Heat. But that's irrelevant. That we already know what happened. But let me ask you a question though. What did you think about the reversal at the end? Like, to me, that's the real trick.
Of her going into the apartment.
So I guess we should say that. Tony, the husband, his plan doesn't quite go as it should have. There's a slight error that happens. The wife accidentally kills him while he's trying to strangle her, which sets into motion a whole new set of parameters. And then he, like you said, Tony is a very very good on his feet, and he figures out a way to use it to his advantage, where he's now going to get the wife accused of murder. And yeah. And by the
you
way, very quick.
You see where this is going. If you've never seen this before, you have no idea where this is going as it's happening. Yeah.
But then the fun part comes in. To me, it's the inspector, played by John Williams, so my favorite character in the whole movie.
Yeah, he's great.
But then again, I love that character in general. He's Sherlock Holmes. Like I said, he's Columbo. He's Agatha Christie. He's what sort of looking for? Angela Lansbury. He's all those characters.
And he's the only thing you don't know in the movie. Like, you know everything. You know everyone's secrets, except you don't know what he's thinking. And you see his eyes going. He kind of is a little you can tell he's a little, like, absent-minded even, maybe.
Yes.
But he always is – and it's just, like, he's like Perot. Like, he's always just thinking ahead, even though he seems maybe like –
Oh, he's very much Perot. He, like, the final scene in the movie, the very final scene is him brushing his mustache.
The mustache. Yeah.
So yeah. Good. He's very much pro, but he's also my favorite because he's also questionable. His ethics are a little questionable towards the end. I'll just say that.
Yeah, right. Like, he steals the purse himself.
Yeah, like this would all get thrown out if this was an American.
Yeah,
court.
Exactly.
But but towards the end, I don't know if you want to get into the end real quick, but
yeah.
There's a reversal. There's scenes in both films, and I don't know if you want me to clip. I have some clips. There's a scene in this movie, and there's a scene in Body Heat, where sort of the little angels on the corners. It's basically telling him, "Don't do this. You're gonna mess up. There's no such thing as a perfect murder. Like, you have it's giving the villain a way out of madness." Mm-hmm. And it's when this one is with Tony, is with Margot and Mark, the writer. And they're about to go out. And he's like, "Oh, you should write a book about this. So how do you write murders?" And he's like, "Oh, everyone could write a perfect murder, but it's fiction. You know, everyone gets away with it." It's like, in real life, I'd probably screw it up, like, you know. And then everyone would laugh at me. In Body Heat, we get a similar conversation.
Parallel, with Mickey Rourke's character.
With Mickey Rourke, and he's like, "They're giving you a way out. You're not gonna succeed. It's gonna mess up."
But there's 50 ways you can mess it up, and you have to think of at least 25 of them.
Yep.
In order to have any chance of
I do have a quick clip because I do want to break up our melodious voices with a clip real quick. But this is the one from To Dial In With Murder. Here we go. It's quick.
You know, you should, Tony, you should write a book about all this.
Why don't you two collaborate? A detective novel with a tennis background.
Yes, what about it, Mark? You provide me with the perfect murder.
Nothing I like better.
How do you go about writing a detective story?
Well, you forget detection and concentrate on crime. Crime's the thing. And then you imagine you're going to steal something or murder somebody.
Oh, is that how you did it? Interesting.
Yes, I usually put myself in the criminal's shoes, and then I keep asking myself, what do I do next?
Do you really believe in the perfect murder?
Yes, absolutely. On paper, that is. And I think I could plan one better than most people, but I doubt if I could carry it out.
Oh? Why not?
Well, because in stories, things usually turn out the way the author wants them to, and in real life, they don't. Always. No, I'm afraid my murders would be something like my bridge. I'd make some stupid mistake and never realize until I found everybody was looking at me.
No such thing as a perfect murder, Ethan. Don't try.
Yeah. And Tony reminds me of Ray Milan. He reminds me of Hugh Grant for some reason. I don't know if you got, if you could.
I was recasting the movie in my head. I was like, if they remade this today, and all I kept thinking about was, could Alfred Hitchcock not get Jimmy Stewart at this time? I mean, I know we love Jimmy Stewart,
very
but
similar. Yeah, they have very similar vibes, I think, to him.
And I think we should say something about Margot real quick, because obviously Grace Kelly has become something ethereal in Hollywood.
Yeah.
What do you think of her?
I love Grace Kelly.
Yeah, she's in a bunch of Hitchcock stuff, right?
Yeah, she's in Rear Window. Yeah, she's in not Notorious.
She's in Rear Window. Is she also in North by Northwest?
No.
No?
Someone else. It says someone I'm not as familiar with.
No, I know. No, I'm wrong. But
To Catch a Thief?
To Catch a Thief.
Yeah.
I always confuse a couple, like Audrey Hepburn and Grace Kelly and a few others. But
Grace Kelly's fantastic here. And I think, too, is because as the audience, I don't think the way these characters are written is to not, we're rooting for them in certain regards, but we're not sympathizing with them, I don't think. But I think her acting is just so much I think just her whole entire persona is just, you're just constantly rooting for Grace Kelly because she's Grace Kelly, right?
She's Grace Kelly,
And she's so sympathetic, and you're just like, oh my gosh, I want to see this. Even though she's like cheating on her husband, she's like keeping the secret from him. Even after she gets blackmailed, she's still like, she doesn't even come forth to her husband. She's paying the person off, like all this stuff. And yet, you know, you watch her acting, it's like a different character almost.
Well, that's the thing. We talked about the Hays Code. One of the parameters of the Hays Code is that bad people had to get what's coming to them.
Yeah.
And, you know, let's be honest, the cheating here is little more than, you know, necking. But the implication is she's an adulteress. And the idea, and again, that's used against her in the court trial. And the court trial, again, we're only going to say this real quick, it's not really a trial like you think. It's not even a, what would you call it? Not even a montage, just sort of.
It's like backlit. It's almost like you just see her face basically.
Yeah, it's actually pretty brilliant how he decides to get rid of that whole thing. Just you're dead.
Yeah.
We're gonna hang you.
It's not even a set. Yeah, you don't even have to think of it as a set or a story beat. Even it's just really quick. Yeah,
exactly. Like,
but I thought it was cool how each of the four characters, I mean, aside from Swan maybe, but they have a different motive, whereas the inspector's motive is finding out the truth, and Mark's motive is justice and like kind of Margot's freedom, and then Margot's motive is happiness, and then Tony's motive is self-preservation.
And money, exactly.
Yeah. Where which could be self-preservation, but yeah, it's just so funny how each of these four people, and none of them kind of, I don't think any of them really are influenced by what another character is doing, even though maybe they're concerning themselves with what other characters are doing. They're never really influenced. Well, they're kind of each doing their own thing, I think.
Let me ask you this. At the end, when she's sentenced to death, and Mark comes back, and he's obviously concerned about her, and he's willing to do anything, and he comes up with this, what he thinks is cockamamie, but it's a Hail Mary thing. Yeah. Why don't we have Tony admit that he planned the whole thing? And he describes in reverse everything that Tony actually did.
Yeah.
Like, but he's presenting it as fiction. So this is what, so Mark's version of the perfect murder is what Tony actually did.
Yeah. He came up with it, and he would have, even says you'd only get like a couple of years.
He's like, no one would believe such a preposterous thing.
Yeah, and you wouldn't even go to jail for that long for this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly, and it's just that's to me that's the real fun revelation.
Yeah,
and
yeah, I know it's really good. It's a great detail that he throws in there.
If you think about it, that's what Tony's doing. Tony is getting even for the adultery in a way by becoming what her lover is, which is a mystery writer. But instead of writing in a book, he's writing it in real life.
Yeah,
but he slipped, and I'll be honest with you, I did not see the twist coming. Like at first.
No, me neither. The first time I saw it, I didn't. And I watched it with she had never seen it. Well, we watched it together the other day. She didn't see it coming,
And it's right there in your face.
It's right there.
But they obfuscate it by misdirecting you to the scissors, to the silk stocking.
The letter.
And then you realize what they're talking about. Oh, that's right.
He has to have a key, too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. His own house key. It's always something little, and it's such a small thing, and it's resolved so nicely and so perfectly that it's just, you don't feel cheated. You do not feel cheated whatsoever at the end on that particular thing.
Yeah, I love Dial M for Murder because it's, in a lot of ways, it's kind of the quintessential Hitchcock film, and I think it's the vibe people think about when they think about Hitchcock. They think of a movie like this. Maybe, you know, you watch maybe a like Notorious, and it's definitely a Hitchcock movie, but I don't think it's how we've kind of mythologized Hitchcock movies, if that makes sense.
I think Hitchcock has been reduced to spectacle from a lot of modern audiences.
Yeah,
I think,
exactly.
I think they think of Psycho. I think they think of Birds. I think they think of North by Northwest. I think they think that, but like North by Northwest, of course. I'll be honest with you, North by Northwest is one of my favorite Hitchcock movies, and the spectacle parts are my least favorite parts.
Yeah.
My favorite part is the performance from Cary Grant, which I love him in that movie so much, so dearly.
He's hilarious.
I love
He plays it comedy, yeah.
Exactly. He's fantastic. So and I love the duplicity of it. I love the misdirection. I love all that stuff. And as groundbreaking as Hitchcock was, like I said, Birds is very visually groundbreaking. I don't know if you knew this. I don't know the name of the system, but that was actually those effects were handled by
the Birds.
from Disney.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah,
wow.
Like,
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah, if anybody's listening, if you want to hear a really, like, a redemption story unlike anything you've ever heard, I'll cliff note it for you. Disney and Ub Iwerks, the team that created Mickey Mouse and Disney Animation, like, he did everything. They broke up, and Ub Iwerks just made a rival studio, and it was a colossal failure. Colossal. Yeah. And he was destitute, and Disney wasn't mad. Brought him back in the fold and put him in charge of effects. And he created the live-action effects that you see in things like Birds or Mary Poppins and everything. He went off to, like...
Interesting.
Yeah, he went off to make Disney better. But he was never going to be the lead. He was always going to be the supplement to Walt Disney. And but Hitchcock recognized that, too. Hitchcock knew special effects. He knew how to make things. He knew when to use and he knew when not to use. He was the master of it. You know this. Like,
yeah.
Again, you probably have seen this, too. Alfred Hitchcock Presents, the show.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people don't know this, but that's who made Psycho. He used television cameras. He used
that's
television
right.
crew.
Yeah, because I guess a lot of people, there was a reason why, to save money or something.
Save
He's trying
money.
To do it on the cheap, basically.
Mm-hmm. Do it on the cheap. And to be honest with you, it's one of his most striking films, and it's made with television equipment.
Yeah. Psycho's a perfect movie, if you ask me.
Can we just say something, though? But television film stock, like, in the 60s, looked pretty good. So, like...
It's true. It did, yeah.
Yeah,
like, you look at old, like, Star Trek movies, or TV episodes, and it's...
Well...
It looks good. Like, the quality's really good, whereas you watch, like... Even on, like, streaming services, you watch, like, some 90s sitcoms, and it's like, oof.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they couldn't get a better quality than this.
There's a reason for that. If you're a big fan of Twilight Zone, which I hope you are...
Yeah.
There's like a season when they switched to tape to film.
Oh, really?
It's awful. It's
terrible.
Horrendous. It's unwatchable. It's horrible. And they switched back to film to finish the series. But no, you can see the difference with film stock. And film stock is expensive, you know?
Yeah.
It's film, Ethan, when they don't save, like, when they don't tell you minutes, but they say feet. Like, oh, it's like, oh,
yeah.
We got like 500 feet. And so. But no, I agree with you. Psycho is probably the iconic. Although,
yeah, even though Vertigo is like everyone's like, oh, it's the best Hitchcock movie. I think Vertigo is a little bit more flawed. I think it's more of like a visceral experience than anything else.
But it's the best movie of all time. Sometimes.
Yes.
This year it's the best, but next year, I promise you,
I've heard more people. Personally, I've heard more people say that Psycho is the best movie of all time than I've heard people say Vertigo is the best movie of all time. Yes, not that Vertigo is a bad movie.
But AFI.
Great,
AFI says.
But AFI says. Sight and Sound. Come on.
Well, that's an example, I think, of confirmation bias and sort of...
Yeah,
like,
it totally is.
Consensus inertia. Like,
yeah.
Like, Vertigo's a good movie. It's perfectly fine. It's got groundbreaking camera works. It's got one of the best trippy scenes I've ever seen. It's a good movie. It's very good.
Yeah.
It's also got one of the best dummies in a movie history. Like, when he's falling, like, there's this horrible dummy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like, rivaled only by RoboCop for, like, dummy. Well,
like
I take that back. RoboCop's pretty good, but Towering Inferno may have the best dummy.
Yeah. Saboteur.
A good dummy can make a movie, so...
That's true, they say that.
By the way, Kim Novak, like, she was in Vertigo, I think.
Yes, she was the girl in Vertigo, yeah.
Yeah, so, but, I mean, we're arguing, like, gold
versus
silver.
We could do a whole episode on Hitchcock movies.
Yeah, because no one's ever done that before.
No one's ever done that. No, this is way more interesting for sure. Because so I thought it was cool because when I was... So what made me think of pairing these together was within Dial M for Murder, Hitchcock kind of provides you with a dilemma. Do we root for an attempted murderer or a cheating wife, right? And neither of them is a good person. And in the same kind of way... Body Heat kind of gives you this weird dilemma too. Like, do we root for this person or that person or the other person? But what I thought was interesting, and this was the hook, line, and sinker for me, was the two characters in Body Heat are the Grace Kelly and Robert Cummings characters in Dial M for Murder. It's opposite, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones who are doing the murder, whereas in Dial M for Murder, it's the husband doing the murder. And so I was like, that is perfect. They're inverted. It's like the same story. It's just from a different perspective.
Yeah.
And a different
angle. when we get into Body Heat, we can talk a little bit about, like, Double Indemnity and, like,
yeah,
the idea of Noir. But what I love about what I love about Dial M for Murder, what I love is very different though than I love about Body Heat. I love the mechanization. I love the clockwork timing and the mechanization of Dial M for Murder. I feel like I'm watching somebody, which is Hitchcock, play with me, like and dazzle me and putting everything. I don't feel these are characters. I feel these are pieces of a puzzle. I don't feel any of them are motivated by anything resembling human emotions. Like you said, Tony, the main character, he doesn't give a shit. Like, he doesn't care. Like, he doesn't like his wife. He's bored. What does he have to do with the money? He gambles.
He's like the guys in Rope, almost, right?
In Rope. You know what I mean? And by the way, one movie I wanted to bring up real quick before we leave Hitchcock is one of my favorite Hitchcock movies that I have never found a soul that likes this movie. They do not like this film. And it's one of his last films.
Frenzy.
And
oh my gosh.
Frenzy is
one of my favorites.
Really? There we go.
I love Frenzy.
Frenzy.
It's probably top four.
Frenzy could have been made in the 40s with no changes.
So good.
Like, it looks like an older film just with color. And I love it. It feels like a classic Hitchcock. Like, Hitchcock said, I'm going to forget everything I learned from 1960 on. I'm going to go backwards. Yeah. Like, if you watch Dial M for Murder, and I know you like the film, but let's just be honest about something, because this is a good transition time if you're ready to transition.
Yeah.
There's certain types of film, the way films are shot, the way the cinematography is, the way the soundtracks are playing. There's an aesthetic to certain older films that some people can't get into, and you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I don't just mean the black and white. Like, the sort of the affected acting, the accents, you know, the feel.
The way people talk. Yeah.
The acting, you know, dear, what are we doing over here? Oh, goodness gracious, Lord of the hell. You know, I love that stuff. I can watch it. And sometimes the music can be a little overwhelming, and, you know, there's a certain sort of symphonic slathering, like, accompanying every emotion. And again, it's some people like this stuff. They really dig it. It's comfort food for them. But for, I think, modern audiences, they've grown out of that a little bit to some extent. And I don't know if that's fair or not, but I think it's the truth. But I think Body Heat does not suffer from any of that. And I don't know if you want to keep talking about, if you have any final thoughts on Dial M for Murder.
We can go to Body Heat for sure. One thing about Frenzy, by the way, is that's another one. I want to talk about Frenzy someday, but that's one where, again, you see who the murderer is right away.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not a secret. But the whole movie is how this guy's going to get out of being wrongfully accused, basically.
And he goes, and again, I want to be clear, it's also a London-based movie. And, like,
exactly.
You know, it's sort of like, if I could describe what I'm thinking about, like, epochrophally, like, when people talk about movie monsters, there's a certain set where they think, oh, Dracula, Frankenstein's monster, Mummy, you know, and then you think of, like, movie monsters today, and you think Freddy, Jason, Leatherface, you know, there's definitely different, you know, Chucky, there's different schools of thought, and so I think you and I were talking about Godzilla and X-Kong before the show. Like those movies are almost 100 years old, right? King Kong's going on 100 years old.
That's crazy. Yeah.
But yet, they're still superstars. Like, can you name any other franchise or thing from that era that's still as, like, that still makes money like that does today?
I mean, there's not really anything. Besides Frankenstein, there's a new Frankenstein movie, right? But, yeah.
Yeah, that bomb though. It's like the
Lisa Frankenstein. Yeah, I didn't see it.
It's another Diablo Cody blockbuster.
Yeah,
she makes so
much. Diablo Cody blockbuster.
Yeah,
that's the name of my punk rock band, by the way. The Diablo Cody blockbusters.
It could be. I mean, they had the Farouk Assault, but it's just that there's certain types of things, and there has to be something there, and I think. If you're willing, here's what I think. If you're willing to sort of buy into the aesthetic that it's selling and give it a chance, you'll find it a magnificently told, tight story that almost has no loose ends, and it's very enjoyable. But you have to be willing to play on its rules and not like bring certain prejudices with you. But I think that's with all old stuff in general.
Yeah, no, you're right.
So, of course, what do you mean? Of course I'm right. It's old. No, old movies, you know that. There are people that don't watch old stuff.
Yeah, I know. It's like when I tell people the only TV I really watch is like 90s sitcoms or like 80s sitcoms. Mm. You're like, that's not, like, you should watch The Sopranos. And I'm like, but I don't want to watch The Sopranos. I want to watch a bad sitcom. Like, I do like corny television.
I'll tell you what, though, I do like The Sopranos.
No, I know. I'm sure it's the greatest show of all time. I'm just saying, I've told people I rather watch Full House than The Sopranos, and they're like, but Full House is terrible. I'm like, I just like, why? To me, TV is candy. TV's furniture, right?
Well, I'll tell you this. I am annoying to my movie friends. Like, I get obsessed about certain things that I've researched that I love, and I sometimes make that mistake that all enthusiasts make, and you do it too. Sometimes you forget that not everybody gives a crap about what you care about. Or they don't understand it. Or they can't look aesthetically because they're not as enlightened and as open-minded as me. That's the mistake I made. Right. Yeah, it's my own naivete and arrogance. But my favorite film to do this with, my absolute favorite, and this is my capper, my absolute favorite movie to compare old-style filmmaking and how in some cases it's better, I think, would be 1981's Clash of the Titans.
Oh yeah, okay.
The Ray Harryhausen, he didn't direct it.
I don't think I've ever seen that one.
It's on my list for this show, I'll tell you that. Versus the new Louis Leterrier one with Sam Worthington.
I've seen that one. But...
Yeah.
And then The Wrath of the Titans.
That movie got a sequel. Clash didn't, but I'll say this. Yeah. But I always bring up the one scene. If you're watching this, you can tune this out because I'm going to bore you. But it's always the one scene in both movies where both Perseus's face Medusa. Mm-hmm. And in the Harryhausen version, it's kind of his masterpiece. It's the best thing he's ever done filmmaking. It's scary. It's all stop motion. It looks like stop motion. It doesn't look real, but it's amazing. And in the new version, it's all CG. It's all clean.
They try to make it look real.
Yeah, and I mean, she's hot in the new one. It's, you can't, I don't think you could come up with two more disparate views on the same content.
Yeah.
And in that particular case, you could make an argument that old style filmmaking works better. And you can make the argument that modern style filmmaking sort of erases it. Of course, one made more money than the other one, so who do I know? But, and by the way, that movie, Clash of the Titans, also kind of helped kill the 3D thing because it was post-production. They slathered all sorts of 3D, the 2010 version.
And that was during the height of everything was, it was like we were seeing the 50s all over again. Yep. It was gross. And they were charging an extra $4 for it.
And that was the backlash, though. Clash of the Titans was the one film where everyone says this is terrible. It wasn't made for, this was right after Avatar.
Was it 2010?
2010. After Avatar, people said we're done. And I think it never recovered. So, you know what? Clash of the Titans 2010, you helped kill off 3D. So.
And I will say, old style, I think, in a lot of ways, is better than new style. And I think, though, when we look at noir and then we look at neo-noirs, I think it's the one time, because there's some phenomenal neo-noir movies, and I think it's one of the only times in film history where we've tried to repeat something, or at least pastiche something, and it worked really well.
I think we should just define the term. When people say neo-noir, we've talked about neo-noir on this podcast before with Under the Silver Lake?
Roger Rabbit and Silver Lake.
Yeah.
Roger Rabbit. Is that the only other one we've done?
It's willful and intentional desire to mimic certain aesthetics of noir. Yeah. And Roger Rabbit would be neo-noir, I guess. It would be.
Totally. And, obviously Chinatown was the first one to do it. But,
Chinatown was
Dick Tracy,
It's hard to, though. Really good ones. I guess we should say, as we segue into
body shame.
So tell us a little about, let's just get into it. Let's get into body heat. So what's going on with body heat?
Okay, let me get my notes out here.
There's sex.
there's a lot of bodies.
And they get hot. Yeah.
So body heat is about a lawyer in South Florida who kind of, you know, he's like the kind of guy who sleeps around. He sleeps with a different girl every night. Very, you know, he has no interest
Lothario.
In it.
Well, not even Lothario, right? He's just, no, you know, he just wants
he's
the
not
action.
Even like, and he's not even, I mean, it's William Hurt, but he, and you know, he's good enough looking, but he's not like, this guy's not Brad Pitt, right? But he's definitely just kind of doing, he's got good game though, right?
Can we say this is the best he's ever looked?
He did, it's true, right? Yeah, well, he does look great.
Well, question for you, just let's get this out of the way real quick. For the William Hurt question, I had this on my list. Do we like him better with the mustache or without the mustache?
Oh, I don't know. It's kind of blonde, so you can do either way.
Because as soon as he lost the mustache, he lost the hair on his head too. So
true.
That kind of went away.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point. So, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if he would have if he would have scored Kathleen Turner with the bald head.
I think he would have given what we know about the film. So
true, that's true, right?
Yeah, he could have looked like Wallace Shawn. Yeah, and scored Kathleen Turner. Like... Inconceivable! You left me. You're bad. So that would have been an interesting movie.
I need that movie to happen. By the way,
AI, get on it. That's we'll do
fantastic.
AI.
Sorry,
with all due respect to Wallace Shawn, I love you to death. So. But come on, man. Dinner with Andre!
That's phenomenal. Oh, geez, Louise. Yeah, so anyway, it's about William Hurt's character, and he plays this guy, and he has a lot of an ennui. Is that the word we could use for this?
He's
malaise. He doesn't really have any energy to care about anything. And it's hot, and it's smoky, and it's... Yeah. And he's kind of just sweating all the time and just doesn't want to try at all. And so he finally discovers Kathleen Turner one night out, and he's never seen her before. And he's like, whoa, I got to talk to this lady.
She stands out. Let's just say she stands out.
Yeah. And he finds out she's married, and he's like, I don't care. And so right away, you know, this guy is maybe not the upstanding citizen most protagonist would be. Very noir of him. And he's like, you know what, let me take you out or whatever. And then I forget how it happens, but essentially they end up at her place eventually. They make out and, you know, they start this super passionate love affair,
well,
to say
actually,
the least.
Actually, let's just say this. This is one of those things. Let's go back to this real quick because you said all the hints are there, right?
Yeah.
That scene when she lures him back to the house is everything in this movie.
Yep.
That's the most important scene. And you don't know it until the first time you see it, so... Did you catch what was happening when she lured him back? What she made him do?
I don't think so.
Well, I guess spoiler. So she, by the way, this movie is freaking catnip to my ears. The dialogue is so good.
Oh my gosh, it's so good. Lawrence Kasdan writes the heck out of the script.
And this is better than anything Aaron Sorkin's ever written.
It's so good. The script, it's like it's a piano. It's a jazz ensemble.
Here's the dialogue when they first, like, there's lots of dialogue. Here's part of the script. It says, ready, Ned. You know, William Hurt. He says, can I buy you a drink? She's like, I told you, I got a husband. I'll buy him one, too. He's out of town. My favorite kind. We'll drink to him. He only comes up on weekends. I'm liking him better all the time. You know, it's like, it's just back and forth.
Good,
it's no one talks like this in real life, but they talk like this in movies.
Yeah.
And she eventually says, oh, you could follow me. Because it brings up the wind chimes. I want to go home and hear my wind chimes.
Right.
Remember? Which, by the way, those damn wind chimes. Talk about Chekhov's wind chimes all over the place. Anything happens, wind chime, wind chime, wind chime. But anyway, he's like, I want to see the wind chimes. They get to see the wind chimes, and she kisses him goodnight and says, I made a mistake, go away. And he's like, ready to leave, and he goes back, and he sees her standing there, and she won't let him in the house. So he picks up the chair and smashes his way in the house. She is testing him, Ethan, to see how far he'll go.
Yeah.
Will he break in? And we learn later, spoiler, that was part of the setup.
Yeah.
She stalked him. She chose him. The whole thing was a setup.
I didn't see this coming, by the way. And there's a massive twist at the end. And I was like jaw dropped, literally. Mm-hmm. I was like, no way. Did you see it coming?
Which twist? Those like three twists in this movie.
The like major one, the yearbook one, where it.
Oh yeah,
where he's...
I thought of something. I thought maybe she had like the friend, but no, I didn't think that she'd replace her.
Yeah, the yearbook one where he's talking to I forget the actor's name, the other lawyer,
the
detective
other lawyer.
Or whatever. And he's talking, he's like, no, you know what? I think she planned this from the beginning. And and then he goes through it. And as he was saying it, I was like, no way. That makes total sense. I, like, didn't even think about it. And it was right there.
Well, he keeps finding out that she's the mastermind, but he's too stupid to put it all together. But he keeps doing it. He keeps falling into her mousetrap. She keeps falling into... You know, what's funny. We talk about they don't really make films like this anymore. I was thinking about this as I saw The Web unweave. The last time I think I saw a movie like this was probably Gone Girl.
Ooh, that's a good one, yeah.
I'm not saying Gone Girl's as good as this, not, but...
Yeah, yeah, but it's a... I see the parallels, though, where it's just kind of like this mastermind where...
Exactly.
Where, and we see it in Dial M for Murder, right? Where Tony's character in the Hitchcock film, he's always... You know, he might not see every way that it's going to work out, but he's really, really good on his feet. Whereas in this one, she has... Or Mickey Rourke says, you have to think of, in order to execute the perfect murder, you have to think of 50 ways, the 50 ways it's going to go wrong, and you have to, or there are 50 ways it's going to go wrong, you have to think of 25 of them. She's thought of all 50 of them, essentially.
50 like, plus.
And she is just nailing it. Like, she is, there's no one in real life who would think of this many things, but again, we've talked, this is a movie, right?
It's so, a movie, yeah.
It's a noir movie, which is noir always kind of stretches the bounds of reality a little bit, and this is perfectly falls into line with that.
Exactly. And, you know, going forward, though, again, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I wanted to get that out of the way and say, this is where Chekhov's gun is immediately 100% right there, foreshadowing right there in the very first scene. And I had to watch it twice, and then I picked up on the clues. And by the way, wind chimes. Whenever you hear wind chimes, something's going on.
Yeah.
So.
Oh man, yeah, it's all of it, and even I mean the filmmaking's superb and. There's all kinds of Chekhov's, like the, what was it? He's lying in bed earlier in the movie. They show him lying in bed from the top a lot. And then later on, when he's in prison, they show it through the bars from the top. It's just like really good stuff like that. Just he's just got his hands all over this thing. And it's just he's writing the heck out of it. He's directing the heck out of it. And I just thought it was phenomenal.
We should say, for those who don't know who Lawrence Kasdan, you do know who he is. You do.
Of course.
If you've watched movies in the last 20, 30 years, you know exactly who he is. Most famous, I would say, whether fairly or unfairly, he's the one who wrote Empire Strikes Back, Star Wars, and he wrote Raiders of the Lost Ark. Yeah. He's come back into vogue a little bit, despite some personal setbacks. Like, let's just say he wasn't able to carry all of his success into the 2000s. But Disney sort of resurrected him a little bit by having him come back into the Star Wars fold. And I don't know, did he come back for the new Indiana Jones or no?
I'm not sure about that one. I know for sure he was like either a script consultant or he helped write the story for Star Wars.
No, you're right. No, we're both right. He came back to write some of the dialogue for one of the new Indiana Jones between Harrison Ford and what's her face? Oh goodness, Marion. I forget your name.
Marion Jones.
Yeah, and that's what's funny about this whole thing. I had to think about it. Now I love Lawrence Kasdan. I've always loved him. And you might be shocked when I tell you what I'm going to tell you. But when people say Empire Strikes Back is the best Star Wars movie, what they mean is Han Solo and Princess Leia's relationship is the best thing in Star Wars.
Yeah.
Because that is everything in Empire Strikes Back. That's the besides the I am your father thing, that is what I think most people remember. That's the iconic music, that's the relationship, and that kind of dialogue is in Body Heat. That's I love you. I know. You know, it's cinematic dialogue. It's catnip.
You could use a good kissing.
Exactly. Like it, and he would go off to do that many, many times. Like I would think he would sort of the progenitor of this sort of repartee.
Yeah.
And I think Body Heat, I'm going to say this sounds weird. You know, we talk about how some movies are old fashioned. When this movie came out, this movie was being sold as like porno.
Yeah.
And you look at it now and don't laugh at me, but you could put this on the Disney Channel. Like a Disney Plus, and you wouldn't have to. You probably wouldn't have to cut anything out.
Yeah, you could just
a little bit.
You just cut out some of the sex scenes, and you'd be on TV pretty easily.
It would lose nothing.
Yeah,
So
yeah, exactly. And I think, and okay, well, let's bring this into the fold here. So this movie was heavily, I don't even know heavily, but it was very much inspired by 1944's Double Indemnity, Billy Wilder's movie. I mean, some people say it was like the first true noir, kind of like drew
Double
up the blueprint.
Double Indemnity.
Yeah,
I would say that. I love that film, by the way. It's one of my favorites.
It's great. Yeah, but I think what that movie doesn't have, that this movie does have, and to its advantage, is the Hays is lack of restrictions. Mm-hmm. So like, you have the Hays Code in 1944. You can't really do much of any. You can't even. There's so much you can't do in 1944. And you know, you have these two characters who are having an affair, and it's almost not believable how passionate they are in love with each other. Whereas in Body Heat, it's palpable how you know, these people, are they in lust? Are they in love? Like, are they confusing one for the other? Which one are they confusing? Which one is true? And so I think there's that enigma of like what these characters really feel for each other, and it's complex. And I don't think sex scenes are always necessary in movies, but I think you have to have the passion that is in a lot of these movies, in a lot of these scenes in Body Heat, backed, of course, by John Barry's great sensuous score.
I want to talk about John Barry in a little bit. He deserves, but the sex scenes in here aren't really sex scenes. There's sexual actions, but
they're passion scenes.
Most of the time, it's pillow talk. Like, they're just naked, or, you know, she's got his hand on his crotch, or they're naked in bed, but they're having discussions.
Yeah, it's true.
And I wonder if that's also part of the master plan, where in post-coitus, when he's glowing, that's when he's most susceptible to her chicanery, that she can sort of inculcate what her master plan is at that moment. Because she realizes he's insecure about himself. Like, I think, you know, in a post-feminist world, you would say that, you know, his sleeping around, having meaningless sex, he gets nothing out of it. He doesn't get happiness. He's just one conquest to the next. And this is a movie with Ted Danson in it, by the way.
Yeah, right. And he's not even the love interest.
He's the nerd.
Yeah.
What's going on with that?
Well, he's great in this, too. Do you think so? Obviously, I think, I mean, there's very much this, nebulous quality to the movie. There's a lot of fog. There's a lot of smoky.
Oh, very steamy.
So it's kind of like mirroring what's going on in these characters' heads and hearts, I think. And I think you have a lot of times you can watch this movie and say, who, like what I was saying, you're confusing lust for love. Mm-hmm. But I think you could say that Ned, who's William Hurt's character, I think you can say that he is in love with this woman. Whereas I'm not so sure about her, because she obviously might be in love with him.
I don't think she loves him at all.
Yeah. Even though, but it's convincing, right? Like, you're like, maybe she does. Like,
she's psychotic.
You're not sure. Yeah. Well, she might even be convincing herself that she is.
It's not Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction. You know?
No.
It's not Glenn Close, who has an obsessive compulsive for Michael Douglas.
She's on tilt. Yeah, she's on tilt in that movie. Whereas this one's very preconceived.
Well, I guess it's no spoiler to say that you find out that she engineered everything. Meeting him, she knew who he was, she engineered the meeting, she engineered the attraction, she engineered the everything. Everything that happened.
She knows
in the film.
Everything. She's Tony's character
in
Dial in for Murder, yeah.
Yeah, she's everything, except she gets away with it.
Exactly.
So she's the ultimate femme fatale.
I was gonna say something about her getting away with it. So I think you have to have her get away with it in order, as an audience, to kind of justify, because you're rooting for Ned, I think. And it's funny because her husband, Edmund Walker, played by, what's the actor's name who plays her husband in this?
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. What's his name?
He doesn't, I mean, like, you're like, they're trying to murder him. They do
Richard
murder
Crenna.
Him.
Richard Crenna.
Richard Crenna, thank you, from, was he in Rambo, First Blood?
Was he in Rambo? He was in Hot Shots Part 2.
I mean, okay, yeah.
Maybe he wasn't in Rambo. He was in the Rambo clone.
That's right.
Yeah,
I get those two confused. No, but so he's obviously the ill-fated Edmund Walker.
No. I'm sorry. I apologize, everybody.
Hmm.
Oh my goodness. Oh, I'm gonna lose my man card. Oh, he was Colonel Troutman in Rambo.
He was, right? Okay.
Yes. Okay. Oh my goodness. I didn't
recognize
him at first.
He plays the Colonel.
Yes. Oh my God. Right. I need to rewatch Rambo. That's my penance. Sorry.
I haven't seen it in a while either. First Blood.
It's a good movie. It's different.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's very good. Yeah. But anyway, so I thought it was interesting that this husband that they're planning to murder, Is never shown doing anything actually wrong. Like, we're told he's not a good person. We're told he gets his hands dirty at work, but he's never really disrespectful to his wife, really. He doesn't hit her. From what we can see, he's not even really mean to her. We only hear that he kind of is through her, which was she's later established as an unreliable character. So it's just interesting that through all of this, and so at the end, I think we have to see Ned lose, because in order to not feel icky for having rooted for him this whole time, because as an audience, our proclivity is to root for the protagonist, right? That's just something we do, where it's embedded in our brains. And so his demise is the only way we kind of reconcile rooting for him to begin with, I think. Well, and I think so he has to lose.
Well, you know what's funny? We didn't even mention when we talked about Dial M for Murder that the movie was remade in the 90s with Michael Douglas. Because, you know, with Michael Douglas and who played – what was his name? Aragorn and goodness, I apologize.
Oh, Harris?
Viggo Mortensen.
Or Viggo Mortensen.
Ed Harris so and Lord of the Rings, really?
They look so much alike. I get them confused.
That would be awesome if Ed Harris,
Lord of the Rings.
And I saw that movie, and it was what it was. But I want to be clear: the reason we didn't really bring it up is because that's the Perfect Murder, which came out in 1998. That's what a version of Dial M for Murder would have been had it been wrapped up in this more like this sex noir, like this. Yeah. That was like a transmutation. It's a decent movie. It's not anywhere as good as the original, but that movie had sex. That movie was more sexy. That movie was like, if you mix Body Heat and Dial M for Murder, that would be the offspring of it.
Mm.
You know, and of course, Michael Douglas was the ultimate, like, that genre actor.
He played so much of those. So many of those movies.
It turns out he wasn't even playing. Ha, wink.
Yeah.
So, but going back to this film for a second, yeah, so you're right. You're absolutely right. Like, you have to see him lose, but you mentioned the Hays Code. With the Hays Code, the bad guy has to get what's coming to him.
Yeah.
And in this movie, she doesn't have to. She gets away with it. So that's the thing. But are we rooting for her because she outsmarted everyone? Or, I mean, what's the goal here?
I don't think so. I don't even think we're rooting for her. I think it's just like a sour ending. I think we're just seeing, you know, she kind of, you see it glimpses. So early on in the movie, she says, she kind of alludes to the fact that she has a chip on her shoulder. People think she's stupid, right? And then we see Mickey Rourke in a different scene mentioning how you have to be smart to get away with a perfect murder. And then she gets away with it, obviously. Like, so to her, it's a win. But, like, I'm not rooting for her, but I still like the ending. I'm rooting for William Hurt's character.
Well, let me throw an idea at you. What if she didn't win? What if she is the William Hurt character? See, William Hurt is conquest to conquest to conquest, never happy, never satisfied. She is the same. She's like, she seduced a rich man, stole the money, went to an island, and the last thing we see is she's doing it again with another one. It's hot here. Like, the implication is she's doing it again with another person.
Yeah.
Maybe she's never happy. Maybe her life is just repetition, just like the William Hurt character, like Ned's.
Yeah, man, that's a good point.
I mean, I'm reaching, but you know.
But there are, but you know what? That's what I loved about this movie is I couldn't stop thinking about it. I couldn't stop thinking of the different layers to it and the different. There's a lot of complexity to it that, I mean, you watch Double Indemnity, and that's a complex movie too, and it's very.
It's told complexly. Because it's reverse told, but.
Yeah, but it's emblematic. But it's emblematic of the film noir era. But it doesn't have as much. It doesn't reach as far, I don't think. And I think everything that you need to know was in the four walls of the movie, right? Whereas I think here in Body Heat, I think there's a lot more outside of what you're watching on screen that you could kind of just theorize about.
Well, I think part of the fun of Double Indemnity. I mean, I love Fred McMurray. Like, I want to be clear. You and I have watched a lot of these early 80s films and earlier. So many of these films, and this is a phenomenon that all modern people have. If you grew up watching TV, you said you watched TV junk food. I don't know if you ever watched like My Three Sons or Follow Me Boys or any of those old films.
I don't know Follow Me Boys, but yeah. I know My Three Sons, though.
We grew up with Fred McMurray as a comedian, as a family man.
Yeah.
And to go back and see him be like sex addicted, crazy like detective or whatever, is a stretch. Kind of like seeing Leslie Nielsen was a Shakespearean serious actor before Naked Gun or Airplane, or Ted Danson in horror films. You know, like wow, these people had a life before. And but I would think the reason people love Double Indemnity more than anything else is because of Raymond Chandler, the writer. Mm-hmm. And Raymond Chandler is the best noir writer who ever lived. And I probably ever will ever live, if we're being honest with you.
Did he write The Postman, All His Rings twice, or is that
I don't know. But what he did is he created a template and a style.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense? Like,
yeah.
And he wrote film, too. And what he did is he transposed that style into film. And so we talk about dialogue the way people talk, like, hey, where are you going down there? Oh, I'm going nowhere. Well, I'll go with you nowhere. I'll go nowhere with you. You know, like, that sort of back and forth. Yeah. That's Raymond Chandler. Like, he originated it. Mm. And it's amazing. Like, if you read it, like, you and I, you said you wanted to be more well-read. Read Raymond Chandler. Yeah. He's easy. Like, it holds up. Like, it absolutely holds up. In fact, it's the opposite of dated. You want it to be sort of stuck in. Yeah, like, the dialogue in Body Heat, Ethan, could easily be from a 50s movie. Easily. Mm. It's not really that dirty. And when characters say, you know, F-bombs, it almost brings you out of it.
Yeah, right, yeah, totally.
Does that make sense? Like, it's like, wait a minute.
It's very it's classic, but it's, although there's, you know, nudity and stuff, it does have this really distinct classic feel. And I think a big part of that is the score, too, and the cinematography.
And I have my final clip, and I promised you a final clip that will parallel what we've already heard about the plan going to rot. But I think this clip also brings into what you just said about the score. And if you don't mind, my final clip.
That's all there is to it?
No, that ain't all there is to it. You gotta get in, you gotta get out. You gotta pick the right spot, the right time. And you gotta try not to get famous while you're in the act. That's all there was to it. Any idiot could do it.
Sorry.
Hey, now I wanna ask you something. Are you listening to me, asshole? Because I like you. I got a serious question for you. What the fuck are you doing? This is not shit for you to be messing with. Are you ready to hear something? I want you to see if this sounds familiar. Anytime you try a decent crime, you got 50 ways you can fuck up. If you think it's 25 of them, then you're a genius. And you ain't no genius.
That's the Mickey Rourke scene. He's only in the movie for, 2 minutes?
It's his only, one other scene, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, and, but there's rock music playing in the background.
Yeah, you know, Bob Seger.
Yeah, Bob Seger, and he's swearing, and it's cut from a different film. It doesn't feel.
It is cut from a different film, totally.
I guess maybe I should have prefaced it by saying that's the scene you were talking about when Ned he's trying to find a way to kill the husband, so he's going to what obviously was an old client of his he got off for arson to build an incendiary device so he could, let's just say, dispose of the body. And he's being given every out. Like, you're not going to do this. You're going to fail. You know, this is not going to happen. Don't do this. Don't listen. You know, because he can do it.
Yeah.
Because it's not his plan. It's her plan. But he doesn't know it's her plan. He thinks it's his plan. But she's manipulated him.
And it's so funny because I was like, why is Mickey? I mean, I don't think he was Mickey Rourke yet, right? This is before and all those movies. But I thought it was interesting that there was so much dedicated to this character and this device that I was like, okay, just for this one thing that, like, to kill a husband, I get it. But then it comes back around later, and mm-hmm. it really, really works with, obviously, the shed out in the back. And
yes.
Yeah, I just loved it. So good. This is a movie that I think Lawrence Kasdan had an exact vision for, and I think he did exactly what he wanted to do with it. And I think he had it. I think he could see the entire circle around him, if that makes sense. You know, like, he could see every single beat of what he wanted to do, for better or worse. And I think he just absolutely nailed it.
Well, again, if you go back and read a little bit about what was happening in his life at the time, like, when he was doing this, he was working for George Lucas. You know, he was in that enclave. So I think he had the benefit of having some very powerful friends on the back end. That would help like guide him. But I don't think that's nepotism. I think what it is, it's helping birth a talent that was that was necessary to be birthed. It needed to be away from Lucas. It was moving away from him. It was going to become his own thing.
Yeah, it's what Roger Corman did.
Yeah, exactly. Roger Corman, like we got Jonathan Demme and Ron Howard out of that.
Yeah.
You know, but when people talk about Empire, though, they never talk about Irvin Kershner, like the director, who frankly didn't really do much else of note. I mean, he did RoboCop.
He did RoboCop 2, didn't he?
And he did a bad James Bond pastiche with Sean Connery. But Kasdan went off to do great things. And I said I was going to tell you something here. I wanted to save it. But before I say that, I just want to say, let's just stop and give, I would say, the MVP of the movie, if I'm being honest, and that's John Barry.
After I watched the movie, I was trying to look for a soundtrack if it was available to purchase somewhere, and it's really not easy to find.
No, but John Barry's score is perfect in this film. It is evocative. And by the way, for those who don't know John Barry, I'll just say this: James Bond. So he did the theme, and much, much, much more. And it makes me wonder, because did you know he did the theme? He did the soundtrack for The Incredibles.
The, like,
Pixar?
Really?
Yeah, they didn't use it. Huh. So instead, they actually got, I think, What's-His-Face to do a impersonation of him.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Was it?
Michael Giacchino, I think.
Giacchino?
Yeah,
okay.
Or one of them. Yeah, it's like three people do all Pixar movies. But but John Barry's, even his saxophone is restrained. And by the way, and that's another characteristic of all of these increasingly erotic movies, is they all have saxophones.
Like, I was wondering, was it the first one that kind of had that, or what?
Maybe it's still kind of classy here, though. It's not quite sex. It's still more sax than sex. But man, some of those other movies, they really overdo it on the saxophone.
Yeah, is this the same John Barry who wrote Louie Louie?
I don't think so. Like the song Louie Louie?
Yeah. Or that's Richard Berry. That was Richard Berry.
Okay, I was going to say, like, you're multi-talented. Like, it's kind of like when I saw when I saw John Williams in the in the thing for Dial M for Murder. I was like, John Williams?
Yeah,
imagine. It's like, can you imagine? Like, I was an actor before I decided to go into this jazz thing.
Become the greatest film composer of all time.
No, but John Barry's his soundtrack is so evocative. It's so perfect.
Yeah.
And
really good.
And that's kind of my next segue into this. We could talk about the story all day long, but the one thing I wanted to get out of the way is, I think Lawrence Kasdan does not get any credit. I think what happens is he is underlooked. Everyone talks about Spielberg. Everyone talks about Zemeckis. Everyone talks about so many other filmmakers. Michael Mann. Like, you could name 50 filmmakers from the 80s. But I think Rob Reiner. And you'd be right, probably. But I think Lawrence Kasdan deserves credit for a triptych when he basically outlined three different genres that became staples.
Yeah.
And I would say it would be Body Heat helped basically invigorate an entire genre of erotic thrillers. Like, I think you're right. I think this is where it starts. He did Silverado, which reinstigated the Western. Yeah. Which, by the way, would dominate. Like, people don't understand how successful modern Westerns became. And that stuff went all the way to the 90s.
Like the City Slickers and stuff.
Oh, everything. Like, City Slickers was just a byproduct of it. By the way, City Slickers starring some of the ensemble from Lawrence Kasdan films, especially Billy Crystal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, of course, probably the most important film for him was The Big Chill. And I'll say why. Because
that's true. Oh, man, I forgot he did The Big Chill.
And those came, and those were all back to back to back. And every one of those films created new genres to play, or reinvigorated genres. They were all successful. Yeah. They were all great. And what's funny is that, what's his face?
Even Raiders of the Lost Ark kind of, like,
that's what I'm saying. Raiders of the Lost Ark, or even if we're being honest, Empire Strikes Back as well. Like,
oh yeah.
But on his own, though, the movies he wrote and directed on his own, like, he wrote The Bodyguard. He was supposed to direct The Bodyguard. Jeez. He didn't get to do it. Yeah. They took it away from him. And William Hurt was a big part of some of that, because William Hurt at one time was one of the biggest movie stars in the world. Like, talk about someone who fell off.
Yeah.
And you know, and you have, you know, Kathleen Turner, who would become a megastar of her own. Crazy.
Yeah.
But in comedy,
The Big Chill was one of the, like, I mean, I don't, I mean, there were ensemble casts before that, but that one was like one of the big. I mean, if you look at, like, people who, like, cast where they all became, like, blew up after, like, kind of like the Dazed and Confused type of thing.
Well, I would say a version of The Big Chill that didn't really work, but worked as a good movie. What was the movie that Robert Redford won the Best Picture for?
Ordinary People.
Ordinary People. Good movie, right?
Yeah.
But what The Big Chill did, The Big Chill focused on a generation. And the concept was, we're going to have this ensemble cast of a generation, a very specific, like you called it ennui, right? Like, mm-hmm. we're going to have this very specific generation, and we're going to see life as we intermingle between their problems. And that is, oh my goodness, every movie from 1988 onward, I would say the TV show.
Speaking of baby boomers. Well, the baby boomers are now like able to have lives.
On TV, I would say 30-something, which the show's disappeared, but I think they're making Friends. You know, all that sort of thing. The big ensemble. And I don't think it's around so much anymore, but again, same with Silverado and cowboy movies, but that gave us Kevin Costner, who, by the way, has a fantastic... Did you see the trailer for his new Western that's coming out?
No.
You know, no?
I don't think so. Which one?
He's directing again.
He's directing it?
Yeah, like, he's got two giant movies coming out this summer. What is it called?
He's still doing some good stuff. I mean, like, you know, he's got some good stuff. Oh. He got some...
Horizon.
Okay stuff.
That's what it's called. Horizon.
Horizon. Okay.
Yeah. Do me a favor. When we stop recording this, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're just listening, this is just Ethan and I talking. But no, check out the trailer for Horizon. It's two parts coming out this summer, and they look massive. No, like massive, like big budget, like Dances with Wolves style filmmaking.
He's really? Back. Wow.
Yeah, and of course he got his start.
Good for him.
He technically got a start in The Big Chill, but they cut him out.
Yeah, he was the corpse, right?
Yeah, they cut him out. But but no, then Silverado, he became Kevin Costner. But no, like, I love Silverado. I love the modern Western. Like, I guess that's what I'm trying to say is I think Body Heat's a better movie than Dial M for Murder. And I don't mean it's not a better story, but I think aesthetically, I love the way this movie looks. It is my favorite.
Right. Yeah. Like, I think you're right.
I don't know if it's the cinematography. I don't know if it's John Barry's score. I don't know if it's the writing. I don't know if it's any one thing. But the way this movie looks, right? The way this movie looks on the screen, it's coming out of the 70s, so you still got that nice, clean film look. But you still got a little bit of a modern 80s gloss on it without too much before it became like Touchstone pictures, you know, where everything looks color graded and everything looks fake and phony. This movie looks steamy and dirty and clean and sharp.
And it never goes away. From beginning to end, it has that aesthetic. Yeah.
There's a beginning, towards the beginning, when you see Hurt walk, and the camera sort of cranes up. And my mind almost broke. I was like, oh, that's right. This is a modern film. The camera can move. I felt excited by that. I was like, that's exciting to me. Like, wow, can you imagine what else we could do with this look? Like, it felt refreshing. Like, and it made me wonder, what would Hitchcock have done had he lived into this era? Would his films look like this? Because he was going backwards, like with, you know, what we talked about with, what was the movie we just talked about?
Frenzy.
Like, he was going back to that particular aesthetic. But, what's his name? John Huston. John Huston, who made films in this era, like the, African Queen.
Yeah.
But he survived into the 80s and he made modern looking films that used this aesthetic very well, by the way. Can we just say that?
And he transitioned really well.
He transitioned really well. I would say, but you know, like, can I give you an example of someone who never transitioned? Like Clint Eastwood. Like, if you look at Clint Eastwood films, they're the same. He makes them exact. They look exactly.
He's never compromised anything.
No, he found a look. He's like one of those 70s actors, like, who finds a look and just sticks with it. Like, he found his aesthetic, and it works for him most of the time. Not all the time, but it's same dirty, nasty filmmaking. Like, I don't think Clint Eastwood could have been a filmmaker in the Hays Code.
No, I agree. I'm totally with you on that. Also, I think it's funny. I looked up Hitchcock died a year before Body Heat came out, which is, I just thought was kind of ironic. But
I wonder if he would have saw it. I think he would have liked it.
It's honestly, I was watching it, and here's, I don't do this often, and I mean, obviously, I would say I'm a crier, I guess, at movies.
It depends on the film.
But I especially, you know, I think it's something that I do more than most people, most men at least, let's be real. But I never do this after when the movie was ending, and it's not a sad movie. I don't cry unless it's a sad movie, really. But I've done this maybe two other times, and I was just started tearing up at the end of this movie, at the end of Body Heat.
Really?
Because I was just like, this is why I like movies. Mm. This is why I love movies, is because of this. And, like, it was just very much a reminder of, I think, the magic. And it doesn't even do anything magical, which is funny. It's just, it's very, like, grounded, I would say. But, I don't know. It was something about it. I was just like, and I just thought in my head, I was like, this is why I love movies, is for this kind of motion picture experience.
I had a similar experience when I saw the new trailer for the new Bad Boys movie. Where?
Okay.
what's it called? Bad Boys.
Bad Boys Forever.
Whatever the new one's called. Give me 1 second. Bad Boys Ride or Die.
The new Ride or Die. Got it. Yeah. The one that's about to get it.
Ride or Die. Yeah. I was watching the trailer in front of Godzilla. And I thought to myself, man, I miss the way Michael Bay movies used to look.
Oh,
like,
man.
Like, I know that sounds horrible to say. Like, I am nostalgic for Michael Bay. Because I look at these modern movies, and God will strike me down, but they got that Netflix slime all over it, where it looks like Netflix movies. It's got that same modern, like I said, color grading. It looks phony. It looks like someone was playing with the contrast and the temperature gauge too much. It's repulsive looking. It does not appeal to me at all. Does it make sense?
It makes total sense. Yeah. It's just very, it's too glossy. Yeah, I know. I agree with you. And I think you'd like Fast and the Furious movies because they kind of retain that Michael Bay spirit, I think.
Yeah, exactly. There's a clarity to Michael Bay's films that's very similar to almost, I'm the only person on planet Earth to ever say this, but there's a clarity to Michael Bay that reminds me of Body Heat, where like there's a clear image. Right. The color grading hasn't gone out of whack.
No obfuscation about what's happening.
Yeah, it doesn't look like the color's wrong on your TV. Like, why is Will Smith orange? You know, why is he orange? What happened? Like, why is everybody pink? Like, Body Heat is, like I said, it's that perfect space between we were coming out of the 70s, and I don't know, I'm not a film guy, so I don't really know it, but like that film stock they were using that looked kind of dithered and worn out a little bit. Like if you watch a lot of 70s films, they always, you know what I'm talking about, there's a dithering.
They're grainy. Look. They're grainier. It's like what they did in The Holdovers, what we talked about, right?
But right before they became like super attenuated, like in the late 80s, like I said, anytime you saw Touchstone or something, it's like you knew you were in for a colorful treat. But no, Body Heat is that perfect little balance between the two where the film looks perfect. The fog looks great. You can see the rain. Everything looks great. I can't believe this is his first film.
It's amazing. Yeah. I by the way, I watched the Michael Bay movie last night. Well, he didn't direct. He produced it. The Bumblebee movie.
Finally
watched it. Just Bumblebee, the spinoff prequel, I guess.
Well, that's the first one. There's two of them. There's the new one that just came out last year. Rise of the Beasts.
Oh, is that a follow-up to the Bumblebee movie?
Yeah, it's a direct sequel.
Oh, did not. Well, I thought that was had to do with the like Mark Wahlberg.
No. So,
okay.
Yeah, and
those ones suck, by the way. The Mark Wahlberg ones are terrible.
I will say this. The Bumblebee movie has one scene in the movie that obviously someone's listening to me when I pray. There's a scene when, because it takes place in the 80s, and I think she's on the cliff or whatever, and she's in Bumblebee, and it starts playing Stan Bush's The Touch.
Yeah.
Which again, if you really want to go down that rabbit hole, like that, we can connect that to Mark Wahlberg and Boogie Nights, but... No, we need to connect it to Transformers, the movie from 1986. And I will say this, full disclosure, Stan Bush has been on this podcast many times. And we never talk about The Touch because, in fact, I told him, I said, Stan, look, you got to leave The Touch alone. The Touch, that's been touched enough. Stop touching it.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah. No, it always plays well. I didn't realize it was in the original movie, right?
It's from the director of Kubo and the Two Strings.
Thomas Knight or something.
The Leica guy from Leica Animation.
Yeah,
but
no, it's great, and there's a lot of like this is a tangent, obviously, but it's a lot of Lost Boys references because it takes place in it's filmed in Santa Cruz, and it's set in 1987, which is the year Lost Boys came out. So it's nothing to do with Lost Boys except for the setting. Someone just likes Lost Boys and wanted to make recreate that.
But there is one thing the movie has going for it, is they rightfully deduce that the original G1 designs from the Transformers were better than the Michael Bay designs.
Got
and,
it. Okay.
And like I said, because they aren't real. Like,
yeah,
they look like cartoons. Like, yeah, they don't look like they don't. Optimus Prime's Peterbilt, it does not look like that mega truck in the opera.
Yeah.
But you go with it because I think there's nostalgia to it. And so, mm-hmm. But sometimes nostalgia frees you, and sometimes it's a prison.
Very true.
And I think with Body Heat, it frees you because I think you have essentially a movie that could have been easily done. There is nothing in this film that could not have been done in 1944 or 1952. Like, there's no reliance on cell phones. There's no reliance on anything technological.
Yeah.
In fact, Dial M for Murder, we said everything relies on the key, but in this movie, in Body Heat, everything relies on the glasses. Right?
True. Yeah.
It's a little obfuscation. It's like, oh, this is the thing that's going to trip us up. You know, this is the thing that's going to do this. But no, I mean, what would you say? I mean, besides the sex and everything, I mean, this movie could have been made. Like, the dialogue could have been largely the same, even during the
days. Really, yeah, there's not a lot of swear words. They could have easily taken those out. It's not reliant on that at all. It's very old school. And I think that's another thing. It's like, if this were made now, if someone were to remake or pastiche Double Indemnity, it would have been terrible. It would be terrible, right? Whereas, like, this is something that's, I think, is the perfect way to do it, where you don't feel like, if you watch Double Indemnity right before you watch this movie, you wouldn't say, oh, he's ripping off that movie. You would just be like, oh, it's a similar plot, but it's a completely different movie.
I would say that's true, and I would add something to it. And this is going to sound like a ding at the movie, but for me, it's not a ding. Sometimes I think movies overwrite themselves, or authors overwrite a character, or they overwrite something, or they, like, you and I were talking about Godzilla X Kong before, and I told you one of the great joys of that movie, it's stupid, but it's like intelligently stupid. It knows when to be smart, right? And in this film right here, like, what do we know about the John Hurt character? We know very little. We know he's a lawyer who's messed up, because that screw-up becomes a critical plot point. That's everything latches onto the fact that he screwed up specifically in writing a will, right?
Yeah.
And she clerked at a law office because did she say she was, like, recovering prostitute or something? I don't know.
Yeah, I think she was basically just saying she did stuff she wasn't proud of to get drugs, to feed this drug addiction, essentially.
But she learned enough to know about, again, this is where Double Indemnity comes from. In Double Indemnity, it's all about insurance adjusting. Like, and if something very specific happens, it triggers, like, double payout.
Right. Yeah, you have to know the loopholes to maximize your potential. Yeah.
So she knows the loopholes. That's what triggers everything. She found a lawyer that has a history of screwing up in that specific thing. So she sought him out so that he would also write. And then she screwed it up herself on purpose. Like, it's all about it's all about staging. It's all about staging. But you could have done that in the 40s, 50s. I mean, nothing is exclusive to 1981.
No, very true. Yeah.
Except that hot, sweaty bodies.
Yeah, except the cars, maybe.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine, like, some of those 50s actors without their shirts on? No, thank you. No. Like, 1941 tough guy is like 1981 drunk guy.
So like, Cary Grant could get away with it, maybe, but...
Well, it's like...
The list is short.
Well, it's like when Eddie Valiant took his shirt off in that scene in Roger Rabbit.
Oh, yeah.
And he's got more hair than Sasquatch.
Yeah.
Like, put the shirt back on, Eddie.
Yeah.
But you know, that's the thing, though. Eddie Valiant kind of looked like Wallace Shawn a little bit. Like, can you imagine instead of William Hurt, like I said, not just, like... Would it be realistic, though, to have, like, a less attractive person matching up with Kathleen Turner?
Yeah. But then it's like, would you want to see all those sex scenes, you know?
Yeah. Kind of. No, I don't. I don't want to see those sex scenes. But, like...
Yeah.
And that's the thing, man. People always talk about body image and everything. And I guess let's just get this out of the way before we wrap up. Like, it's a movie. It's not real. These are not real people.
Yeah.
These are fake. But like people, when you go into a silver screen, you want to see a better version of yourself. Or you don't want to see yourself up there. Like, everyone says they want to see themselves. There's no evidence of that. There's no evidence that people want to see themselves on the screen. They want to see better than them.
Yeah.
You know, they want to see some nasty ugliness. Like,
true.
Yeah. So like, if they were going to make Body Heat today, right, who do you think would be the Ned character? Anybody? Would it be possible?
Shia LaBeouf.
Really?
I'm not joking.
No,
honestly, I think Miles Teller would kill it. I think he's kind of the perfect mold for that. Like, he's got that kind of everyman look, and he's kind of making a comeback. Anyway, but and then, man, Kathleen Turner's role, though, I don't even know if you could do that.
That's
hard. I don't think you could do it. I'm sure there's somebody out there, like maybe like a Juno Temple or somebody, but I don't know.
I don't know if they'd allow it. Like, the idea, like, yeah. Did you know they remade Fatal Attraction last year as a miniseries?
Yes. And, I did not watch that.
And no, and they were bragging. Like, oh, the original one. Now, the original film, like, one of the biggest movies of the decade.
Yeah.
Nominated for Best Picture. Everybody loved Fatal Attraction. That was a phenomenon at the time.
It's huge, yeah.
Huge. Like, people don't understand, like, the fact that an R-rated psycho sex comedy could be Best Picture nominee and get all the money. You don't get it. So they decided, oh, it's flawed. We're going to fix it. We're going to focus more on her character and show she was less crazy, and we're going to have less sex. Oh, and I thought to myself, oh, you want to fail. Like, you want to take away everything that people loved about the film.
People watched it, yeah. People did not watch it to know more about Glenn Close's character.
No, and of course it's unrealistic. Of course she's crazy and kills the animals. She's crazy. She's a movie character.
Yeah.
Like, and people say there's no great roles for women. Well, Glenn Close got one. Like, she was great. She was fantastic. And no, they took it away. And the show bombed. Canceled. Like,
was it Joshua Jackson? Dawson's Creek?
Dawson's Creek. And the lady was from that one show. What was her name? She was from that show with Adam Scott in it. Oh, goodness gracious.
Severance?
Was it? No, not Severance. There was that comedy show. They brought it back.
Oh, Party Down or something?
Party Down, yeah. And she was, like, she didn't really come back for the new series, but... She was she was a love interest. She's good too. These are good actors. But we want to see psycho femme fatale. Like, you have to have that. And I don't know if they'd remake it. And if you're not going to do it right, then don't do it at all. That's the thing. Yeah. This movie exists. It exists, you know.
Yeah.
It's not on Disney Plus. Like, you know, they put that mermaid movie on Disney Plus and they added CG hair
to the new one.
What was that called?
The Little Mermaid?
No. Let's not speak of that.
Okay.
Let's never speak of the new Little Mermaid.
Wait, which one are you talking about?
What was the one with Tom Hanks and Daryl Hannah?
Oh, Splash?
Yeah, so when they put Splash on Disney Plus, they CG'd her butt crack out.
Wait, really?
Mm-hmm. They added CG because there's a scene when it's innocent, right? She's got a cute butt.
Yeah.
She's running to the ocean, and they made her hair longer to cover her butt crack. On Disney Plus.
Why have a rating then if you're just gonna?
Oh, Disney meddles with all kinds of stuff. Like
that's insane.
Yeah, that's really that's different than censoring. That's infiltrated. That's like molesting a movie.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
Put Body Heat on Disney Plus. I dare you. You know they could though. They have Hulu.
They put
now.
Poor Things. Didn't they put Poor Things on Disney Plus?
Let's just state this. It's been coming, right? Disney Plus finally merged with Hulu. And so if you have the Disney Plus app, you'll see there's a tab for Hulu now. So there's all kinds of new stuff for you to watch on Disney Plus. Disney Plus is interesting now. It's got Hulu.
Yeah.
We'll watch Shogun. That's good. But no, I mean, like I said, this is a classic noir told through gorgeous cinematography, gorgeous soundtrack. And it's such a well-made movie. And I honestly, it may be Lawrence Kasdan's best movie, but... I have a soft spot for Silverado as well, for very different reasons, of course.
I gotta see Silverado. I've never seen it.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
I will say, on a weird coincidence here, the DP Richard H. Klein was also the cinematographer on 1976's King Kong, which we were talking about Kong and
Godzilla. Ready for this? John Barry did the soundtrack for that.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I didn't get that far.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. That's pretty.
To be fair, though, that King Kong was supposed to be bigger than it was.
Okay, I haven't seen that one, actually, the 76 one.
I think John Gilmore was you said, oh, goodness gracious, you said Richard Klein worked with him on King Kong. Because he was nominated for Best Cinematographer for that King Kong movie.
Yeah, for that movie, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And he did a George Lucas, or not George Lucas, I guess. Well, kind of. George Lucas movie too, Howard the Duck, which was written by the people who wrote American Graffiti.
I love Howard the Duck.
I have
unrestrained like for that movie, by the way.
Yeah, you have. How can you? Yeah, and he also was the DP on Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean the movie.
Man, this guy's filmography is insane.
We've talked about him before. He did My Stepmother is an Alien.
Yeah, Battle for the Planet of the Apes.
Oh wow, he did Double Impact.
Yeah.
No, I'm not joking. That movie. You ever see that movie Double Impact?
I've not seen Double Impact. No.
Okay, the first 10 minutes is in Los Angeles, and look, it's one of those movies. It's a genre where an action star would play his own twin.
Like, okay, yeah.
A lot of movies have done this. Yeah. Anyway, so Jean-Claude Van Damme plays this LH who grew up in L.A. He grew up in L.A. because he was saved from France or whatever his twin is.
Yeah.
And he still has his Belgian accent. Okay. But he does aerobics, and they shoot him in the tightest spandex you see every butt crack of Jean-Claude Van Damme. And this is like prime cake Jean-Claude Van Damme. And it looks so good. Like, I'm not saying he looks good. He looks amazing.
Yeah.
But, like, that movie, you know somebody talented made that. Like, I know that sounds weird to say that, but you just solved the puzzle for me.
It's one of those movies that's made better than it is.
Yeah, it's made better. It's still fun. Yeah. Oh, like, the best Jean-Claude Van Damme movies are always, like, C+.
Yeah, like, I just watched Bloodsport for the first time, like, a year ago, and loved it, honestly.
It's good. Oh, it's good. It is. Yeah. It's good. You have to see that other movie he was in right before Bloodsport. He played like the silent bad guy.
Target?
No, that was John Woo. No, the one where goodness gracious, what was that movie he was in? Goodness, we can sort of wrap this up in a minute.
Yeah.
But now you must make me know because this movie's horrible. Let me find it for you. No Retreat, No Surrender.
Okay, yeah. I've never seen it. I've only seen Bloodsport of his movies.
What? No Street Fighter?
No, I've never seen Street Fighter.
No Universal Soldier?
I've never seen Universal Soldier. I've seen Mortal Kombat.
He's Time Cop?
Never seen Time Cop.
Quest?
No, I've never seen any of his. Well, you got to say, I was born in 89, so by the time I was old enough to watch
Cable
movies like that,
Cable,
no one,
even.
I know, but no one was like. Like, aside from Cable, I'd like turn it on and I'm like, okay, there's that or Showgirls, like, you know,
Kung Fu Panda 2.
Well, okay, I've seen that.
He played the crocodile.
I've seen like Expendables and stuff.
Okay, Expendables 2.
Yes, I've seen that.
Where he played the villain. His name was Vallon.
Vallon, yeah.
He's a villain named Vallon.
Gotta love Expendables.
Yeah, that was Expendables is like Terminator. There's only two good ones. And that's it. There's only two. There's nothing else. Nothing else happened after two.
No, there's no coincidence that Richard Klein has worked with some pretty phenomenal directors. William Friedkin, Robert Wise a bunch of times, Brian De Palma, Lawrence Kasdan, obviously.
Robert Wise was another one of those guys that was able to transform his look into the modern age.
Yes.
And very well.
Oh, right? Yeah. Really yeah. Well, yeah. Norman really well. Jewison, he worked with on I've never seen his movie, Gailey Gailey.
But I think we can both agree that aesthetically, like, forget the great writing, forget the great everything. Aesthetically, Body Heat looks and sounds amazing. It looks and it looks fantastic if you're watching.
Yeah.
If you're watching 4K Blu-ray, it's amazing.
And I think that's why it's so to me. It's I think it could be it's on going to be my perfect list, perfect film list because. It's a movie that the script I believe is knocked it out of the park, and it just aesthetically is pleasing to watch and hear.
I only have one quibble. One quibble. It's minor. I told you this before. The last scene in the film when he's explaining to his buddy, right?
Yeah.
Oscar, about what had happened. I feel that's when the movie becomes a little bit like Dial M for Murder, where it's telling you what happened instead of showing.
Got it. Yeah.
And it's like, oh, but this happened, and this happened, the glasses did this. And reality, I think we could have smudged that down a little.
But then we get a really great scene where the bookmobile guy or the, you know, the delivery
that's
man
perfect.
Or whatever is.
Perfect.
Oh, it's so good. And that's the reveal right there. That's the big finale.
Exactly. So it's just...
Rectifies it, yeah.
Because
I get what you mean, though. Yeah, it's a little bit like Norman Bates at the end of Psycho... With the psychologist describing what he's going through, yeah.
He's like, oh, he did this and that and this and that. But yeah. I'll say this, though. But that kind of stuff works better in a book. Because that's literally what you're doing. You're reading it. And I think Dial M for Murder does that very well, too, is that, again, you could listen to it and get everything out of it. You don't really need to see much of it. But no, I think this is a sumptuous film. And when I say it's better than Dial M for Murder, that's not a slight to Dial M for Murder. That's not a competition.
I think you're right, though. I as an all-around experience, though, I think it's more rewarding, right?
And I'll say this. I think this movie was sold as a sex movie, sold as erotica. I think it persists because it's a good mystery and it's a good example of noir. But yeah. I think it would be fair to analyze it as just an extremely well-made film. And coming from a first-time director is kind of astonishing. But mm-hmm. but I think that's what happens when you're surrounded by people. And let's be fair here. Let's be fair. And I think you can agree with me, my final thought, that the 70s was an explosion that changed Hollywood unlike anything that's ever happened. I think
yes.
you had – I mean, of course you had Spielberg and Lucas – Francis Ford Coppola, Martin Scorsese, you know, you had tons and tons of filmmakers. But again, I say this again, I think Lawrence Kasdan should be in there. I think Lawrence Kasdan was responsible for a lot of that stuff, like both writing and directing. And he just doesn't get the name recognition that I think. And mm-hmm. I think part of that may be because, you know, his latter films weren't that great. You know, what was the last movie he made? I know he made a really bad Stephen King
film. Isn't he supposed to come out with one this year?
I'm going to find out.
I saw that somewhere.
Let me see here. I just want to make sure I got this right. November Road, he says. Yeah, he hasn't had a film since night. I didn't even saw the last week at Ed's. He worked on Solo, a Star Wars movie.
Yeah, that's the Star Wars one I was thinking of.
But I think he's kind of disowned it a little bit, though, like most people.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was out of commission for almost 10 years.
It says November Road, whatever the heck that is. Would love to see that. He's directing it.
But I think maybe coming back into Star Wars reignited something in him.
Yeah.
Because, like, he was dormant for almost a decade. Like, nothing. And then this. And so...
Yeah.
But I would have liked to see what his version of Solo and, you know, the Miller Lord version would have been like. As opposed to, the Ron Howard version.
Did you see Wyatt Earp?
Oh, yeah. That's what I'm saying.
I've not seen that one either.
In the 1990s, right? And let's just say this. I told you Silverado was... Silverado's shockingly innovative. But, like, there are so many good modern cowboy films. Like, westerns. Tombstone. Yeah. You know, Wyatt Earp, Ned Beatty.
Dances with Wolves.
Just so many. But they... You know, like you said, Young Guns. Like, they were modern. They were kind of fun. They had that let's go on adventure. Like, a Star Wars film. Like, that Star Wars aesthetic. The... You know, Raiders of the Lost Ark aesthetic.
We're forgetting about Back to the Future Part 3.
Oh, yeah, exactly. No, that's exactly a result of it, because that was a huge genre. And I think that's what, even when Clint Eastwood came out of, like, you know, Purgatory to say, one more for me.
Yeah.
Although his wasn't as fun. His was a serious film. But, you know, one of Kurt Russell's most famous roles was it Tombstone?
Yeah, Tombstone.
Yeah, people love that movie. People love, even though it's not realistic, it's fun. You know, it's...
Yeah.
It's fun, and, you know, maybe we're, you know, that's what I'm saying. I'll give Lawrence Kasdan all the credit in the world for helping start that up.
Yeah.
But Body Heat is up there now. It's up. It's either my second or my third favorite Lawrence Kasdan movie. I love this film, and I've never seen it before you recommended it. So, yeah, I'm really happy.
Yeah, I watched it for the first time recently. I think it was only the second time where I've watched it, and as I was watching it, I was like, I want to do this on the podcast. The other one was Elephant Man. Where I watched
which
it
done.
And I was like,
and I
watched it and I was like, that's going to be our next episode.
I have a recommendation, which I'll tell you in private after, but I will say this.
Okay.
My final thought on this movie is I didn't realize how much I love Kathleen Turner. And I grew up watching her in comedies as Jessica Rabbit and Romancing the Stone and Man with Two Brains. Mm-hmm. And the last movie I saw her in was, and this is my fault, was when she played in Dumb and Dumber 2.
Dumb and Dumberto? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
That's a terrible movie.
The Mighty Had Fallen, but she had that perfect, sexy smoke appeal. But then again, you just introduced me to the genesis of Jessica Rabbit. She's from this movie.
And,
you know, like, literally, she's quoting that character.
Femme fatale.
And
also, let's give credit to William Hurt, who I think... I think we kind of know what to expect when a character is guilty of a crime in a movie. And you know, he tenses up, he kind of, or he like panics, or he maybe parlays his misconduct into more mistakes. But I think the William Hurt kind of plays it nonchalant. He's very unreadable. And he kind of drowns his he drowns his malaise in like these like unconventional facial tics, which he establishes early on before he's guilty. So it makes sense when we're watching it. I just thought he was he played it in a really unique way that I appreciated.
There's a scene at the very beginning when he goes in the men's room to get some tissues, and he sees the gay male prostitute.
Yeah,
and he looks at him and he starts going like just makes a noise at him. And you know what I mean? Like, he does little quirks and tics like
idiosyncrasies. Yeah, it's just,
or like the
building the character.
Well, here's something for you. When remember when he's caught like pre-coitus and the little girl catches him and
oh, that was such an awkward scene, but it worked. Oh man!
And you can tell his friends know he's guilty and they're trying to give him an out. Like, oh, you can go out the back door. He's like, no, I'm going to do this.
Yep.
And he goes and talks. Look, did you see what he does? The little girl says, oh, someone with their hair slicked back. Do you know what he does when he's talking to her?
Does he slick back his hair?
No,
right?
No. He put his hair forward so he would look different.
Oh, okay.
So he confronted, like, he does that like 5 times in the movie. He's like, oh, like when he settles her will and he's like, oh, you better leave that one alone. She's like, oh, why would I leave her alone? I don't have any money. She can't. Like, did you see her? I'm going to go there every night. I'm going to make the mistake every night.
Yeah.
He's so arrogant.
I don't think I've seen anyone play guilty as entertainingly as him in this movie, honestly.
And like, wait, I do like William Hurt a lot, and I loved seeing him evolved. He's such a weird movie star, but
he is.
But
yeah,
and I'll say this: I know he got ensnared in the MCU for a couple films as what's his name, Thaddeus, whatever.
I don't even remember him in the MCU. Who did he play in what? Oh, in
He was
in the Hulk.
Oh, he was in like the Incredible Hulk, Captain America, Civil War. He was in both the Avengers movies.
I don't remember him in the MCU.
He played it like he was a small character, but his characters, you know who's replacing him? They're recasting him. Harrison Ford.
Oh, that's the Harrison. Why are they recasting him with Harrison? Really?
Because he's dead.
Oh, wait, he died?
Yeah, he died last year.
I didn't even know he died last year.
No, he died 2 years. Sorry. He died 2 years. What's the date today?
Because he's dead, you said.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good reason.
Well, to be fair, this is Marvel. Like, being dead doesn't matter. You know,
it was like Gary Shandling was in the Marvel Universe very briefly. It would have been cool to see that evolve.
Gary Shandling? Really?
Yeah, he was in
Iron Man,
like some politician.
He was in Iron Man. Yeah, Iron Man.
Yeah, and I think they were going to evolve him into something bigger, and then he died. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, I know they got rid of Robert Redford, though, so that would have been interesting. But
yeah.
No, I think... Yeah, he came and went. I mean, he ended up becoming like one of the most profitable films of all time. So I think that's a good career. For all his personal life problems, which I don't want to get into. No, he's entertaining. I've always liked William Hurt. And by the way, not to be confused with John Hurt, who we also love,
which well, also in Elephant Man.
Yeah, who we also love, but for very different reasons.
Yeah.
But no, check it out. So I think maybe this is a good time to wrap it up.
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's wrap it up. See, we solved the mystery. We spoiled it all. And it turns out I was the killer all along.
You're welcome.
Yep, and you were my femme fatale. So, Ethan, I want to thank you once again. So you've been listening to another episode of the Movie Time Podcast from PopZara.com. I've been Nathan Evans. And the other voice you heard, the more intelligent, sexier voice, has been Ethan Brim. Ethan, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you.
And with that, you have some good films to watch. Let us know what you think, and we will see everybody next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Pop Zara podcast. Remember to like, follow, share, and subscribe on your favorite podcast app or service.